Spirituality means waking up. Most people, even though they don't know it, are asleep. They're born asleep, they live asleep, they marry in their sleep, they breed children in their sleep, and they die in their sleep without ever waking up. They never understand the loveliness and the beauty of this thing that we call human existence. You know, all mystics, they're all unanimous on one thing, and that one thing is, all is well. All is well. Everything's in a mess, and all is well. Strange paradox. But tragically, most people never get to see that. They never get to see that all is well, because they're asleep. They're in a nightmare. Most people tell you that they want to get out of kindergarten, but don't believe them. Don't believe them. All they want for you to do is to mend their broken toys. Give me back my wife. Give me back my job. Give me back my money. Give me back my reputation, my success. This is what they want. They want their toys repaired. That's all. Now, even the best psychologists will tell you that. They'll tell you people don't really want to be cured. What they want is relief. A cure is painful. Waking up is unpleasant, you know. You're nice and comfortable in bed, and at least as long as you're asleep, it's irritating to be woken up. That's the reason why I told you the wise guru will not attempt to wake people up. I hope I'm going to be wise these days and make no attempt whatsoever to wake you up if you're asleep. None of my business. My business is to do my thing, to dance my dance. If you profit from it, fine. If you don't, too bad. As the Arabs say, the nature of the rain is the same, but it grows thorns in the marshes and flowers in the garden.
Happy heresies, and welcome to the desert of the real. Welcome to Aeon Bite. Excited to see everybody today. My name is Miguel Connor, and I am your pompous of Gnosis. And yes, everywhere I go, I get slandered. I get libeled. I hear words I never heard in the Bible. But I am trying to keep the customer satisfied, which is you, a wonderful people who come for those esoteric secrets and solutions that work for you and only you. And it's always an honor to host once again an individual who I've pretty much read every book he's read, and I've always enjoyed anything that comes out of his high weirdness head, and that is Gary Lachman. Gary, thank you very much for coming back on the show.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Miguel. And I want to say I've never heard Simon and Garfunkel evoked to a greater purpose. So there you go.
You're very welcome. I had a question for you. It's a little strange. Years ago, we were talking about David Bowie and your encounter with him. I am writing a biography. Paul Tickna, his book, Starman, actually quotes you in his book when David was getting in trouble in L.A. and all that other wonderful stuff. Mm. But I remember you saying you had no patience for young Americans. So what did you think of Station to Station?
I heard all that in the background. I have to say, I was an early, well, for me, early Bowie fan. I first started listening to him probably about 73, and I was 17, going on 18. And then really got into, used to listen to him, as they say, religiously. Just before started actually playing in New York, but Diamond Dogs is probably the last one that really got, you know, into, and all the kind of, you know, sort of, well, it's kind of not exactly, but the sort of slightly occult flavored fascism sort of hovering around, and it's really cool. And in 1984 and all that, and we have someone to save us, the brave Apollo and all that kind of thing. But then I remember with a couple of friends who were, you know, really, we were all Bowie, you know, fanatics. We went to Madison Square Garden, but then it was gospel. It was Young Americans. Like, well, no, we wanted Ziggy Stardust and all that. But, you know, he was somebody who evolved and, you know, and all that. And I mean, I don't know if I want to tell, but, you know, the Bowie story is the one where I got kicked out of his loft in Manhattan because I told him he didn't know what he was talking about when he was going on all this stuff about Colin Wilson. But I won't tell that now. I'll say that's in my book, New York Rocker, My Life in the Blank Generation.
Oh, good.
Got to find that book.
Yeah, can't wait, because I know he was very into Colin Wilson at one point in the 60s and stuff. Very definitely informed his worldview as much as Burroughs in so many ways. But, oh, well, he could change on a dime. So that was the Bowie we loved. And with us, too, it's always great to have the Moondog Vans. Vans, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Glad to be here this morning, at least my morning. And took the day off so I could be with you, Gary, because I'm still working.
I'm touched.
Yeah. So I'm hoping you'll shed a little more light on my confusion about Gurdjieff, because I'm... He just bugs me for some reason. Mm. Right? He just bugs me.
No, that's
his job. Right place.
His job is to bug everybody around him as much as possible.
he's working on me.
He generally did. So there you go. Even from afar, he's
wow. That's power.
Yeah. Well, you came to the right place, because Gary's new book, Maurice Nickel, Forgotten Teacher of the Fourth Way, which I enjoyed, is a sort of a bridge to Gurdjieff, Uspensky, Jung, Swedenborg. I mean, this is, I was impressed, Gary, because at first I was like, oh, Maurice Nickel, this is like reading a biography of Mick Ronson or Syd Barrett. It's like, yeah, they're important, but they're not Bowie or Roger Waters or David Gilmour. But then I was like, this dude is very important. He was the bridge. He was second in command to Jung. I mean, he really created a lot of advances in esoteric Christianity. And even as you write, his ideas on Jung might be as important as the Red Book himself in understanding Jung. So this is this is no Mick Ronson. This is a rocker on his own, right?
I mean, Nickel's a very important figure. I mean, if nothing else, not too many people had Jung, Uspensky, Gurdjieff as teachers, or had close relationships. He certainly had a close relationship with Jung and also with Uspensky, and he spent some time with Gurdjieff, but he actually got to know both of them. I mean, Jung, around this time, this is 2024, so a century ago now, which is, it always makes my mind sort of tilt when I think, my God, this is... go now, this sort of thing. Used not to be when I was first reading about it. So Nickel would have been Jung's lieutenant, as it were, in the UK. He was someone involved in the early years of deep psychology, psychoanalysis, analytical psychology in England. And he's part of this infighting that's going on ultimately between Freud and Jung, and then you have Ernst Jones, who was Freud's biographer, and he's sort of Freud's bulldog, as it were, and he's trying to cut off the Jungian rump from the true echt Freudian, you know, psychoanalytical community and all that sort of thing. But Jung had expected, you know, Nickel to, you know, carry the banner for him here, and he actually wrote one of the first books in English about Jung's psychology, and this is very early on. It's called, it's a book called Dream Psychology, which is it's worth reading. It's definitely worth reading, but it's very early Jung. But then Nickel attended a lecture by Peter Damian Uspensky, who was he's always sort of portrayed as a mathematician and scientist, but he really wasn't that. He was a writer, he was a journalist and a poet, and a romantic philosopher in that sense, because you have the pyramids there, and he wrote His most famous book is Book Called In Search of the Miraculous, which is about his account of his time with Gurdjieff. But they got the title, because it was published after his death posthumously, they got the title from an earlier book of his called New Model of the Universe. And in that book, he has a chapter called In Search of the Miraculous. And it's about his travels in India and in Egypt and, you know, that the Taj Mahal and the pyramids and Notre Dame. And there are all these poetic kind of pen portraits of these esoteric sort of places. So he was a rather poetic kind of character. But then he went through the Gurdjieffian mill, which I assume we'll get onto. And the collapse of Russia, the collapse of the Romanov Empire, the Russian Revolution, the Civil War, and everything else funneled Uspensky and Gurdjieff into Turkey, into Europe. And then he wound up coming to England, and he was giving lectures here. And Nicol attended one of them, and he was electrified by Uspensky's lecture, and he sort of basically jumped ship from Jung, wrote a Dear Carl letter, and he said he was changing his allegiance. So he and then Uspensky became very, very close with him, and come and stayed with him. He used to live not far from where I live here in London, a place called Chester Terrace. It's over by Regent's Park. It's very upmarket. And Nicol came from a very prestigious, well-known family, and he had a very prestigious practice on a street called Harley Street in London, which is, if you know London, Harley Street is like, ooh, if you put your
shingle,
your brass plate, your shingle on the door on Harley Street, then you've made it, you know. And he gave all that up after he encountered Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff came to London and gave a lecture. Insofar as you call it a lecture, he basically stared everybody down for a half hour before somebody got up the nerve to ask a question. And then he announced that he was starting this institute in France, in Fontainebleau, outside of Paris. And then pretty much all of Uspensky's people just crossed the channel, and Nicol was one of those. So not everybody had, you know, close contact with all three of these figures that are, you know, very important in the history of Western esotericism, but just in general in the history of, you know, sort of 20th century culture.
Fascinating. Yeah, I guess the $64,000 question is, why would you jump ship from Jung to Gurdjieff? I mean, we all know Jung didn't like Gurdjieff, like Vance. So you would think that these ideas were like far apart. I mean, what sparked Nicol to leave?
Well, I think it had more to do with him personally, his own quest, or his own sort of working out of his own sort of development, spiritual development. I mean, what Jung would call this individuation. I mean, in some ways, they're not that different. And in fact, I think if you look at all these people dispassionately, a lot of ways they're all got the same, not the same ideas, but they're dealing with the same problems, put it that way, because it's all the problems inherent with our human psyche. And believe me, there's enough for everybody. They can go around.
That's for sure.
So
we all got, so, mommy, you know, so there are,
it sounds like, you know, it's the many roads to the mountain, but there's also many mountains. So, but I think with Nicol, it was something like, if I can put it simply, Jung left too much up to him to sort of deal with. Here's the material. Here's, you know, here's how you would deal. Well, I mean, again, we'll get onto them, I guess, but these diaries that I've used in writing the book, Nicol really went to town in trying to understand his dreams and applying Jungian, you know, strategies, whatever, you know, hermeneutics to understanding the dreams. And even Jung said he was doing it a little too much. It was like he was over signifying the different symbols and all that. But he took it very, very seriously. But he felt that he just didn't, he wanted somebody to kind of bang. So I think he wanted more of a traditional guru than someone like Jung, who was kind of a mentor, but it was sort of like, here's the material, then, you know, work on it himself. And he had some sessions with Jung. He did, you know, Jung did help him personally. I mean, his father, this was his Nichols' father, William Robertson Nichols, was this alpha male, you know, kind of very, very important at the time, political writer and religious writer and all this. And he was this dominant figure. And Nichol was a sensitive, you know, introverted character. And he had developed a stammer from the sort of somehow always being in this kind of, you know, subject to this intensity from his father. And Jung got him over that and things of that sort. So he did some, you know, therapeutic work with him. But he really wanted somebody to grab him and take care of him, say, here, this is what you do. And Uspensky's, the teaching that Uspensky brought, and we're getting into Gurdjieff's ideas. I mean, the funny thing was that Uspensky was kind of a, he wrote this book called Tertium Organum, which is a work of speculative metaphysics. And he's talking about higher dimensions and the fourth dimension and mysteries of time and cosmic consciousness and this potpourri of all this stuff. It's still a fascinating read. And I can't go into this long story. Talk about In Search of Miraculous, this long story where it winds up becoming a bestseller. He doesn't know anything about it. He gets money sent to him and suddenly he's a very rich, important wife of a newspaper baron here. Says, you know, money, no object, you know, Miraculous is here. I'll meet you anywhere. Do you want to come to London? Yes. So she ships him out to London and he's here. And T.S. Eliot and Aldous Huxley and Gerald Hurd and all these other people are coming to these soirees. She's, you know, laid on for him in St. John's Wood, which had a certain recherche character. If you know the Dennis Wheatley novels, most Americans don't, but if you know them, he was like a British pulp cult writer. Well, a lot of the Hammer, 60s Hammer films are based on Dennis Wheatley novels. All this weird stuff happens in St. John's Wood. And so any case, Uspensky's, you know, but the message he's giving at these talks is not the kind of speculative metaphysics that about higher dimensions that he writes about in the bestseller. He's talking this very austere doctrine of Gurdjieff's, which is fundamentally that we think we are awake, we think we are conscious, we think we have free will, we think we, you know, act out of our own volition, but all those things are illusions, and we're actually machines, and we're asleep. And a very dour, pessimistic kind of doctrine, but, you know, there is a way not to be a machine. There is a way to actually awaken. And Uspensky, I mean, again, Uspensky was a very well-known theosophical writer in Russia in the early 20th century, and Gurdjieff saw him out because he needed a front man. He needed a front man much in the way that Madame Blavatsky needed a front man, and she got Colonel Olcott. Who was very, very good, very tactful, you know, he good organizer. And Uspensky was like that as well, as on top of being the brilliant, you know, writer and thinker and all that. And Gurdjieff sent his students that he had at the time to basically ensnare Uspensky. And then Uspensky got involved. And it's a famous story where he had just come back from the search for the miraculous I mentioned, his journey when he was in Egypt and he was in Ceylon and he was in Japan. He was like all over, you know, and this was a time when you couldn't just backpack it, you know, in Ryanair. You know, he was like on, you know, sailing vessels and all these, you know, it was when travel was really travel. And he had come back and he believed there were schools where he had conducted all these experiments with altering his consciousness with a variety of different means, yogic means and breathing techniques. And he experimented with nitrous oxide and all these sorts of stuff. And he got some interesting results, but he thought that it's not good unless there's some discipline I can apply to, you know, basically access these conscious states of consciousness at will eventually, you know. And he said, but he believed there were schools, actual schools, you know, and, you know, secret, like, sort of like Madame Blavatsky's Mahatmas, but, you know, but not quite, you know, some Sufi teachers somewhere or something like that. And that's what he went in search of in these places when he came back empty handed. And he was a bit jaundiced about all of it. And these people kept approaching him saying, no, you must meet this certain Mr. G. And he said, oh God, you know, I just come back from, you know, just in Egypt, I was in India. You know how many Mr. G's I met? You know, I'm just sorry. No, it sounds and I'm not trying, I'm just doing it to liven it up a bit, but you know, that's basically what his attitude was. But eventually he caved in and he met him. And when he met him, he was electrified. And they met in this back street Moscow cafe that was occupied by, you know, small time businessmen and, you know, streetwalkers and whatever, and all this kind of stuff. And the funny thing is that it's like, it was almost like a Marx Brothers kind of thing, or some kind of, you know, comedy sketch, because Monty Python or something, because Uspensky describes Gurdjieff as being in disguise, but poorly disguised, so that you know he's in disguise. He knows, you know, he's in disguise, and he's waiting for you to, like, yes, you know. And they get into this, and Gurdjieff just is the man who knows. He's the one that Uspensky wanted to meet in the places he went in search of. And oddly enough, he met him in his own backyard. And then for the next 5 years, against the backdrop of World War I, you know, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Civil War, and all of that, he and a band of other early students, you know, or with Gurdjieff in these different places and all that. And then after that, Uspensky decides that he's learned enough and he's going to go on. But he completely rejects his earlier work, at least Tertium Organum he does, and he's going to teach the system now. And this system, as I said, it's much more complex and involved than my just saying that he says, you know, we're all asleep. It's like, how many gurus say that sort of thing? But that's it actually, you know, he had very convincing arguments, and Uspensky was no pushover. So for him to be convinced in some way, and Gurdjieff himself was someone that was not asleep. He had, after many years of struggle and search and all that, and, you know, he went on his own search in Central Asia and discovered his own secret monastery, the Sarmon Brotherhood, and all that. So he struck everybody who met him as more or less somehow extraordinary, that there was something about this guy, you know. So Nicol attends one of these lectures, and this whole idea that, I mean, many people walk out of them like, what is this, world asleep? Oh my God, this is, you know, they want to hear theosophy or something else like that. This is too austere and strict for them. But Nicol is, I keep saying electrified, but this is what happened. He's sitting like, it's like a Zen moment, and he just, you know, this is it. And he felt that he needed that kind of very strict, austere kind of tough Spartan approach to it, that he thought Jung was just leaving too much up for him to kind of deal with. So
yeah, I completely understand you. And Vance, as Gary writes in his book, another commonality, yes, both Gurdjieff says we're all robots, Jung says we're unconscious, both men were great cooks, which I had no idea about. So Jung was a good cook. But Gary, I think it's interesting, because in another part of your book, you talk about how Jung would come to England to visit Nicol, and they got along. And one time, Emma, Jung's wife, came down. Mm. They started talking about dreams, and Nicol's like, well, what do you think of all this stuff? And she's like, I don't know. It's like, she kind of agreed with Nicol, like, well, what do you do with it? Mm. But I think that's an important distinction, because people get frustrated because in some systems of Gnosticism, early Neoplatonism, Zen, and all that, you're not supposed to do anything. It's the old, what you are looking for is what you're looking. The old St. Francis, you're supposed to just observe, and then what is real comes to you, what is false dissipates. But other people, right, that, no, I want exercise, I want altered states of consciousness, I want a spiritual regime and all that. So it really comes down to what's your poison, right?
Or I guess it's different temperaments, I think. That's one of the things, too. In a way, I mean, not quite exactly, but like the difference, say, between Catholicism and Protestantism, or inversely, in the East, the mystic East, the difference between Hinayana or Theravada and Mahayana, which it's kind of backwards this way, because you have Catholicism, which is more like Mahayana Buddhism, because you have the ritual, you have sort of the different practice, the robes, the imagery, the incense, the chanting, you know, almost like Vajrayana, like Tibetan Buddhism. You know, there's magic, you know, ingesting the body of blood and all that. And in Protestant, it's like, no, cut all that magic out. It's just you and God, and that's it. And the Bible, that's about it. That's the only thing you got. It's just you and that's it. None of that stuff. That's all. Yes,
like a court. Yeah. Protestantism, yeah, yeah. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And but I mean, in the Buddhism is the opposite. It starts with the Theravada, which is very austere. It's just you and you working out diligently around salvation. There's no bodhisattvas. There's no innumerable Buddhas in the innumerable universes, that's all great. Helping to, you know, bring on the liberation of sentient beings. It's just you and the palm tree, wherever you are, doing this. But then later, they have the Mahayana, which is the big boat, the big raft and all that, and the Hinayana, which is, that's not the name they call themselves, but that's what the Mahayanas call them. They're the guys on the little boat. It's just you on a little raft, but we have everybody. So it's different temperaments. And see, even in like, say, you know, Western or Christian kind of mysticism, there's the via negativa and the via positiva. Via negativa is sort of like Meister Eckhart, you know, you prune everything down to the basic absolute nothingness, minimum, you know, poverty of the soul, that kind of thing. But then there's via positive is all the imagery, you know, Dante and visualizing, you know, ascent through the planets and whatever, different versions of these things. So it's different temperaments. And I think, you know, with Nickel particularly, he was somebody who was, very, very deeply troubled by a kind of standard self-division between the, you know, desires of the flesh and the those of the spirit. He grew up with the very dour, you know, he was Presbyterian, Scott. So he grew up with this very dour, you know, talk about, you know, like it's all, you're all predetermined anyway, you know, you're all going to go. That's it. Nothing you can do works. No. That's it works. Will advance you nothing. But, you know, maybe, you know, try it and see what happens, you know, contribute to the church and maybe, you know, that might be something, you know what I mean? Or if you do well and all that kind of thing. But no, he grew up with this feeling that he was completely alienated from the religion. He grew up in the congregation, and he talks about feeling like he did not belong. And this had a lot to do with this strange stuff that emerged in these diaries, where I have to say I was completely surprised to discover that he was obsessed with sex. Not to go into too much detail, but as I say in the book, it was an obsession that he pursued with one hand, as it were, if you catch my drift. That's a whole other story. And again, he over time and over years, he actually develops a kind of, self-sex, erato mystical kind of practice, and it's divine feminine and all this sort of thing. And it's not that different than, say, other people at the time were doing. Curly, you know, we know was doing a sexual, and we all know there's a whole history of tantra and a variety of things like that. But in Nickel's case, peculiarly, he grew up with this real sense of kind of, you know, what we would call bad self-esteem. You know, he felt, you know, he was sinful because he was thinking about sex all the time when he was a kid and all that kind of thing. And but he also, in a way that's not unfamiliar to tantra and other things like that, he somehow the forbiddenness of the sex is somehow the same as the transcendental character of the religious experience, because he really did feel some kind of, you know, the people going to the church, that's not the real church, that's not the real Christ, that's not about the real religion, it's not this kind of dour sinful stuff, there's something much more, you know, powerful and alive, which he tries to bring out in these later books he wrote about the esoteric interpretation of the parables, where he expands on a couple brief remarks that Gurdjieff made when he was talking about the history or the origins of what's called the work or the fourth way. He said you could call it a kind of Christian esotericism, but it was a Christianity before Christ. So, which could be Hermeticism. We know in the history of that the Corpus Hermeticum was seen as some way either a presage of or a fellow traveler with, or perhaps the source of, blah, blah, that kind of thing. So it's not far off. But that's the route that Nickel later went down. That was the sort of his path, was this outwardly, he became a teacher of this work, and he taught it in England, in what they call the home counties, just like outside, you know, London, on the outskirts of London. But in his own inner life, he pursued this kind of sexual, you know, mysticism. And at least according to the diaries, which are like this 1,000+ pages of them, and they're not as readable as the Red Book. You know, the Red Book actually, there's a narrative. I mean, Nickel's diaries they're very fragmentary, and it's he writes in a code sometime, and you know it's mind numbing after a while. Somebody's going to have to, you know, apply some really, you know, acute editorial skills to that if they want to publish and make it you know, available. It's available in the University of Edinburgh. People can go up and, I mean, that's how it. I wound up getting it. A student of Nickel's, a fellow named Sam Copley, who did write a book about him, called "A Vertical Man: A Portrait of Maurice Nickel." They were in. He had them, and he had passed them on to his family, and his family made them available to a researcher up in Edinburgh at the university, who's keen on Nickel. And he's the one who went to the trouble of transcribing them from these sort of notebooks to, you know, making them a file. It must have been an enormous amount of work, and I applaud him for doing it. And but I mean, they're. I don't want to say 90, but it's around there. Percentage of it is occupied with his sexual fantasies and these strange mystical states he would get into. Also, but there's also all this, you know, stuff that you want to hear it. His relationship with Jung, his relationship with Uspensky, his relationship with other people around him, his students, and all that kind of thing. So it's because he's kind of, if you know. If you sort of know the history of the work, and if you know the different people involved in it, he comes across as one of the most congenial, accessible figures in it. I mean, Gurdjieff's this crazy, madcap, who knows, wild card, you know, guru guy. You never know when he's acting or not. Uspensky was this iron taskmaster and logician who, just through sheer mental effort, you would, you know, awaken. Nickel was somebody. It was like, he was like a Chestertonian, Father Brown kind of figure. You could go to the local pub with a vicar and have a pint with him and talk with him about things. And he would tell jokes, and it would be more like that. And so this was this outward, I mean, and I don't know if you know the detective series Poirot, you know, the Hercule Poirot. It was a TV. Well, if there's all these kind of drawing room murders happening in the 30s, Nickel would be. He wouldn't be a figure out of place in one of those kinds of things, because he's like in a white suit and all this kind of thing. And he looks very much like a figure from that kind of golden, gilded 30s kind of age and all that. And he himself wrote some detective stories. That's another thing, too. He was a best-selling author before he started any of this, under a pseudonym. He wrote a couple books that were bestsellers. They even made into a film. It's a lost film, but the BFI, the British Film Institute, is on their list of like famous lost films. And he wrote for the Strand magazine, which was the magazine that Conan Doyle wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories in, and all that. So, again, he was a fascinating figure with this, what they say today, backstory, history, I guess, is the old word we used to use. But but in any case, yeah. So, but the diaries just, they open up. You know, we usually don't know about the inner life too much of these kind of figures, you know, or. We know about Jung, but then Jung was, you know, crafting the Red Book, and he helped craft Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, and all that. Right. And these diaries are very raw, very, very raw material, you know. I think, you know, in many ways, those of us who are interested in him or interested in the history of, you know, Western esotericism in the modern age, or whatever you want to call it, you know, should really be grateful to the family for making them available.
Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Indeed. Vance, do you have a question or super chat from the audience?
If you have
any questions for Gary, please super chat.
Let me have a sip, okay?
Sure.
Here we go. Let's see. Get this up here. Our friend Anon says, and this is for you, Gary, does sexual mysticism remain strong as the libido diminishes with age?
Interesting. The libido diminishes with age? Who told you that?
Hopefully it's not his experience.
Why did you believe them?
Yeah, somebody putting saltpeter in your food.
I'm sure this is out of place in this day and age, but I'm reminded of the old Groucho Marx line, you're only as old as the women you feel. That's horrible. I'll get some horrible mail for that. I personally I don't want to answer that question. So it doesn't have to, although I guess there are some, you know, physical hurdles that present themselves at a certain time that, as Gurdjieff would call them, the lawful infirmities of age.
But that's not even true, Gary, because the studies show people with Alzheimer's have insane libidos.
Well,
something
go.
Gets blocked off and they just go crazy. So something's up.
Yeah. So check back with me in another 10, 20 years and I'll let you know.
Fair answer.
We'll ask you to put both hands up, Gary, to make sure you're kosher during the interview. So any question from you, Vance?
Well, gosh, you should have one, but yeah, I'm still wondering about Gurdjieff, and did he claim that he was enlightened? I mean,
he wouldn't use the word enlightened, but
awake.
Well, I put it this way: he didn't have to claim that he was awake. He would show that he was. People around him, and again, he was extraordinary in the sense that he was able to do lots of things. There's all these stories. I mean, in a way, he comes across as a Superman. Okay, just to put it in the simplest way, there's all these stories, especially at the Prairie, at the Institute for Harmonious Development of Man, which was this. In this old chateau outside of Paris in Fontainebleau, and all these remarkable stories of like there was a sudden fire out of nowhere, and he appears out of nowhere and smashes the wall down with a hammer, and you know, puts the fire out, and then there's a boiler that's starting to break down and explode, and he takes lumps of clay and throws them at the boiler and covers the holes, and you know, the chateau was so completely run down. That's why he got it. The whole idea was it was all physical labor, not all of it, but there was a lot of physical labor. A lot of physical labor is what he called conscious labor. So you somehow had to stay alert and awake and aware of yourself as you're doing all these activities, nailing things, chopping hedges, cutting the lawns, whatever, all that kind of stuff.
Chop wood, carry water.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and so, again, in some ways, some odd reason, I found myself recently reading a lot of Zen. I've gone back to reading D.T. Suzuki, who I read, God, when I was first getting into this sort of stuff ages ago. Yeah. And it's not that different. The Zen moment is very much about being alert and awake and alive. And it's a kind of shock tactic. But that's Gurdjieff did the shock tactic too. Not so much with koans, not with just like what? Sound of what? Not that, but like situations. He would create situations in which you were taken out of your comfort zone. Heck, you were even taken out of your discomfort zone. You know, you're just taken out of wherever you would be normally, usually. And he would create what I call artificial crisis or artificial inconvenience. And that forced the people there they were confronting reality in the raw. Suddenly their usual responses to things weren't working. And they weren't given a break to like, oh, let me figure out something else now. It's like, well, you're on the move and you got to do it. And there's all these remarkable stories of also like, and you know, just that it's just like, you know, they built something they called the study house, like from scratch. And most of the people there basically came from pampered upper middle class or upper class, you know, backgrounds, intellectuals. I mean, one of the strangest stories, you think about it, just and it sounds trivial, but J.G. Bennett, I don't know if people know his name anymore, but he was one of the Gurdjieff students who later went on and developed his own thing. He had a place called the Sherborne Institute here in England, and Robert Fripp from King Crimson, he was one of the students who went there and all that. But he talks about when he was at this prairie at this chateau, and he was given the job of what they call kitchen boy, which is what Nicol had when he first showed up. And there was like a puddle of water on the floor or something like that. And Bennett was transfixed. He didn't know what to do. And suddenly someone gave him a rag and they soaked it up. And oh, my word. You know, and it's like, and this guy was in British intelligence and so again, one of the things that I say in the book, and I think just makes sense, you know, somebody who had spent, you know, a lifetime sweeping floors and, you know, chopping wood and all that, it wouldn't work with them necessarily because they're used to doing that. But these guys, but the whole idea was the work itself was not necessarily, it wasn't Tolstoyan kind of, you know, labor as salvation itself. It just was, it was a means of putting you into a situation that was completely uncomfortable and unknown and new to you and forcing you to be other than, so as you said, it bugged you. Well, yeah, that's what he did. He did, and he also arranged groups of people who worked together who he knew wouldn't get along. So he knew their temperaments would grate. And so, but he said, the first thing was like, you must remember that you came here only to work on yourselves. You came here, you know, to become aware of the very things that I'm going to make you aware of, and you're not going to like that, but that's why you came here. And so this all, you know, and I'm giving a quick kind of description of it, but there was a deep philosophy behind it. And
yeah, that's very helpful.
He incorporated lots of different things, Sufism, some people say something, some Tibetan Buddhism or whatever, but he also was, I think, a very, very acute psychologist in himself. And he had studied human nature for years before. And I think he made a living as a hypnotist for a long time, you know, curing alcoholics and drug addicts. And that was another thing. Unlike Aleister Crowley, he was very adept at making money. He was very adept at just turning over businesses. He had like, you know, at this, you know, institute in Fontainebleau, and it's like a 40 miles outside of Paris. He would drive into Paris and he had cafes and, you know, other kinds of businesses going where he was making money from them, to selling rugs. You know, he'd have people like sew, you know, make kind of Turkish rugs, and then he would go sell them as Turkish rugs or something like that. You know, he was very street smart. He had that kind of Levantine shark kind of, you know, a way of like, you know, he would survive, you know, no matter what happened. And he was taking care of like numerous people. He had like a whole families and families of Russians who like just wound up the prairie because he would take care of them. So Yeah, he was a remarkable individual. Was he a Superman the same way? I don't know. You know, I mean, in that sense, I mean, I'm sympathetic. I'm critical in some bits in the, I mean, one of the funny stories is about how abysmal a driver he was. And people were terrified to get in the car with him, but it was also a special deal if you went for a drive with Mr. G. And if you, it, even more special if you survived, if you came back. But he would just drive and drive and drive and run out of gas and then make you whatever, walk back for just, again, creating inconvenience, pushing you past your normal everyday limits. And he was a master at that.
Interesting. He's a professional pain in the ass.
Socrates was the gadfly, you know.
Yeah.
But much the same way, people ran away from him once they saw him coming. Because, oh my God, it's that Socrates guy, Jesus. Well, they wouldn't have said Jesus. But
I wonder if Gurgis didn't get his thing from Plato's cave, too, because, you know, they were all asleep, right, in the cave. So
Yeah. I mean, it's a metaphor. I mean, the metaphors are there, but they're there for a reason.
So, yeah, it's funny about the driving, because his famous metaphor was the horse and the driver, right? And then the horses are just taking you away in the carriage and you're asleep in the carriage.
That goes back to Plato, but Gurdjieff used the same kind of, you know, scenario, and others have as well. So that's why I say he talks about different centers. There's an emotional center, an intellectual center, a moving center, an instinctual center, and a sexual center. And then Jung talks about, well, we have different functions. So you have thinking, you have feeling, you have sensing and intuition. Gurdjieff talks about essence and personality. Essence is what's really your own. Personality is something that you acquire over the years. You know, you put it together in order to deal with the world. Jung talks about the persona and the self. So similar, not exactly the same, but I would say, you know, not that different. And another similarity between the two of them, just personally, is both of them liked physical labor a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jung did all that stone carving and talk about chop wood when he lived primitively in Bullingen in the tower. He didn't have central heating. He had, you know, he had chopping wood and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I always wonder, I mean, people have asked, did they ever meet? And there's a story that, who's the guy who had Count Kaiserling in the 20s? He had something called the School of Wisdom in Darmstadt. Hmm. He was one of these other sign up like B level, great, you know, B movie esoteric teachers at the time. But he knew Jung, because Jung used to come to and talk at his School of Wisdom. And he asked if he had ever met Gurdjieff. And he said, no, I had never met him. But I've always thought, oh, I wonder, you know, what would have been like the two of them checking each other out. You know?
For sure.
Like the Hulk and the Thing or something, you know.
was he at all spiritual? Did he believe in an afterlife or spirit?
Well, there's different sort of things. I mean, his initial teaching is very, but it doesn't come naturally. Unlike the theosophists who sort of, or the spiritualists, you know, once we die, we go and we're there. So no, you have to work on, you have to create.
You have to earn immortality.
Sort of like the diamond body, you know, you have to create it, or like in Taoistic alchemy, you have to create, you know, the secret of the golden flower and all that. So Gurdjieff, he calls it the Kesjem body. And it's something that we create through effort. So there's a lot of what he calls, and there's conscious labor and there's intentional suffering that you take on intentionally for a reason. And, you know, and one of the great sources of that is the struggle between yes and no. There's a friction created between yes and no in us, and we struggle. And the more we struggle with that kind of tension and friction, there's a metaphor Uspensky gives in his book In Search of Miraculous. He says it's like a kind of container here, and there's these sort of metals that are in a powdered state, but through the heat of the friction of yes and no, they solidify and they become, you know. So it's all this kind of stuff you feel when you say I am, and you feel it rattle in there, That's the whole idea. So it's very much about, in the same way as Jung with individuation. It's not about blending into the one. It's not about, you know, the dewdrop slipping into the, you know, the mm-hmm. sea, whatever. It's about you affirming your individuality. It's existential in that sense. It's about you affirming your I-ness, you know, but the real one, not the fluctuating different eyes, you said that, you know, we're afflicted, but, you know, we decide we want to lose weight. So, okay, tomorrow morning when you start the diet and you wake up and you have like a huge full English breakfast here with, you know, sausages and bacon and eggs and everything. It's, oh, I forgot about the diet. Well, I'll start later. You know, so it's that kind of thing. It's like, you know, make one thing your God is one of the things he would say, you know, try to make one thing you have to take one thing you really want to do and see how difficult it is actually to do it. You will start to see the world around you will somehow start to conspire to prevent you from doing this one thing. But you have to, if you stick to that, that's part of this, you know. So I know a lot about that, having to write books all the time to make a living. So, you know, it's, you know, you just, there's a resistance and you overcome the resistance. And then, you know, out of that friction, something's created with any luck.
Yeah.
It seems Jung is more popular than ever, Gary. Everybody now talks about shadow work and synchronicities and da, da, da. It's like, it's almost like, I don't know, he's newer than ever. It's amazing how popular Jung is. You know, you and I, we've grown and, you know, there's always like ebbs and flows. So, but Gurdjieff is also very popular. You know who quoted him? While he was getting a star in the Hollywood Walk of Fame, it was, oh my God, I'm drawing a blank, singer for Van Halen. Not David Lee Roth. Sammy Hagar.
Wow.
Yeah, he quoted, well, I mean, he quoted, you know, Gurdjieff. He said it was one of the reasons he had been a successful musician and da-da-da-da-da. So, surprise.
Well, I mean, when I lived in L.A. Ages ago, I was involved in the Gurdjieff work for a few years in the early 80s. And I knew lots of people, a lot of actors were very interested in it because there's a lot of psychodrama. There's a lot of like role playing and things of that sort. I mean, like I said, I've been talking about kind of thumbnail sketch, the most kind of, you know, immediate sorts of things, but there is a whole kind of role playing and psychodrama sort of thing. And I knew actors at the time because I knew people that were doing that were very interested in his work. And I mean, Bill Murray, you know, from Saturday Night Live and all that. I mean, he's still a name to conjure with, I guess. So, I actually attended a Gurdjieff celebration once many, 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 many years ago in some place just outside of Manhattan, New York State. And he was there. And so that was, you know, they tend to keep, I mean, there's the Gurdjieff Foundation, which is the real thing. And then you have different sorts of people have picked it up. I mean, somebody who picked up on it was Marion Williams, you know, or she, there's a symbol called the Enneagram. That's a whole other thing, you know, that is part of this, which I haven't gotten into. It's, you know, it's complicated, but she's somehow taken that and applied it to other kinds of things. But there's a purist strain, which I think tries to keep it, you know, they keep their cards close to their chest and they don't advertise and they try to keep it, they don't proselytize and go out and, you know, try to get followers. I think if you're interested, you have to kind of track them down.
But like you said, Gary, one of the contributions is Nickel made it much more approachable and easier to do, maybe less, more psychological, less arcane or whatever. So that was a big contribution. And also for his ideas in Christianity and his struggles with Christianity, as you write in your book, Swedenborg was huge and really that's another piece of the puzzle.
I mean, towards the end of his life, he died in the early 50s. He became more and more interested in Swedenborg's ideas, the 18th century Swedish savant scientist, really, at the time, who later went on became a kind of mystical philosopher. Swedenborg himself wrote an esoteric interpretation of Book of Genesis and Revelation, which I think it's like that. It's called Arcana Coelesta, you know, the secrets of the heavens. And what one can only be thankful that he didn't go on to the rest of the Bible, because we can't imagine how many books that would have been. I think he, you know, again, I'm being silly about this, but but Nicole, the similar thing, but his books are very, very, very thin and all that. Swedenborg himself practiced the kind of sexual mysticism. If the researchers of Marcia Keith Suchard, who wrote this remarkable book some years ago called Why Mrs. Blake Cried. And Mrs. Blake was the wife of the poet William Blake. And she cried because he wanted to sleep with the maid. And this was all about this free love and, you know, sexual mysticism that Blake was learning about, hearing about in London at the time, which some of it derived from the Moravians. And in that book, I said, Marcia, she put the rave back in the Moravians. It's all about the kind of free love practices that they were getting into at the time, and so on and so on. So you have a whole culture of this going on in the back in 18th century London, and Swedenborg was involved in that. And but also this for Nicole, it moved from a kind of strenuous, how should we say, spiritual warfare, let's say, where his approach, it was much more congenial. It wasn't as tough and demanding as either, or in some ways dull. It was tough and demanding with Gurdjieff and kind of dull with the Spensky's groups, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a bit more alive and friendly and congenial and warm and approachable. But then later towards the end of his life, he became more and more interested in the work of Swedenborg, and also Meister Eckhart, and a kind of something much more like a letting go and letting God, rather than this kind of diamond hard affirmation of the self. But, you know, he was older, he was ill. So, you know, at different times, different things, you know, attract us, and you know, again, there's many ways, many mountains, and all that kind of thing. So
yeah, I love that part in your book where Jung was visiting and he had a ghost apparition in Nicole's house. Some woman with half her face showed up in his room, and Jung was completely freaked out. I mean,
no, it's a Nicole rented a cottage outside of London on the Anglian coast. And I mean, I said Jung. They've been out there a couple times, and I Jung was there, and Nicole got the place very cheap. And the reason why is that the people renting it, they said it was haunted. Mm. And Nicole himself was he would do these kind of rituals to Hecate and to Hermes and to He was very interested in, he read lots in the Gnosis and Hermeticists, so he was doing. He was looking for something, you know. He was young, and then he was doing this kind of stuff, and then he was reading theosophical works and Freud, you know, also, and just he was looking quite a bit, and so he would be doing these kinds of things, half fun, half serious, you know, at the cottage, and there's stories of Jung, you know, painting, like, you know, he was painting again. Nicol knew Jung when Jung was going through the whole Red Book episode. He knew him when he was having his descent into the unconscious, as his mm-hmm. Nekia, you know, the night sea journey or psychotic episode, depending on your point of view. Exactly, this is true. And so one of the things I wonder in the book is if Jung talked with Nicol about active imagination and things like that, and that Nicol was practicing that when he was trying to induce these exalted states that he records in his diary. But getting back to Jung and the cottage, and he tells a story that he woke up in the middle of the night, and there's this nasty, nauseating smell and kind of, you know, dripping water sort of sound and all that. And he looks over, and like on the pillow next to him is half a woman's face, and it completely rattles him. And he spends the rest of the night in an armchair with the, you know, the candle lit. But this is the same Jung who had the 12 dead from Jerusalem, you know, show up.
Knocking at his door.
Knock. He didn't bat an eye at that. You know, he invited them in. So it's, as I say, he got scared by a real live English ghost, you know.
Yeah. Well, if it was during that time, Jerry.
I'm sorry?
It was during that time when Jung's channels were wide open.
Oh, so yeah.
He was inviting stuff from everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, but there's a whole other story connected to that, because at different times, Jung, you know, ghosts and all that sort of thing, they're actually projections of the unconscious. But then other times he says, well, I'm not quite so sure whether that covers all the bases or not. And then he would say, well, I've had no experience of such. And you'd say, hey, Carl, what about that time at the cottage? Yeah. So in my book, Jung the Mystics, I say, well, he says that there, he says that here. So Jung was, he played his, even though he was very open about it, but he played his occult cards pretty close to his chest at different times. So
that must be hard, Gary, because, yeah, I mean, writing the Elvis bio, right now writing the Bowie bio, reading a lot about Philip K. Dick is like, people will self-mythologize, retcon, and just have terrible memories. So you go down these roads, right, Gary, and you're like, you are just contradicting. Bowie's the worst. Mm. He will just make a story backwards. Like, oh, well, I meant this when I was doing this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I told you, I was asked to leave his loft by his two female bodyguards at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
They were like Bumper and Thumper and Bambi from one of the James Bond films. So, yeah, there you go. Never trust a rock star.
Never trust a rock star, yeah. Well, as we're getting closer to the end, Vance, do you have questions or any super chats?
Well, I'll give the super chats first. First, here's a quick one, because who's going to answer this? Who built the Great Giza pyramids and the Sphinx? But he paid $2 to ask it. So if you got an opinion, Gary, let's have it.
Who built the Great Giza in the Sphinx?
Egyptians.
Egyptians, yeah. Yeah. Manny Moe and Jack, if anybody remembers that. But
yeah. I'm sure if you asked them, Bowie would admit to building them. No, right.
Yeah, here's a good one, though. What's your take on the blue germ?
It was a great discovery. I write about it at length in the book. I was reading it at the time that COVID was all the rage. And the blue germ is a science fiction novel written by Nicol under his pseudonym Martin Swain. And it's about a germ that makes us immortal because it kills all the other germs. It's a germ that kills all the other germs, and the only symptom is that you turn blue. It's a science fiction novel, and it deals with the question of what do we do with immortality. What do we do with it? And it's actually it deserves to be reprinted. I think it's available, you know, PDF online somewhere. That's how I read it. But it's somebody should an industrious publisher should put it out.
Interesting. I wonder if the Blue Man Group was inspired by that.
Could be. How long have they been around, right?
Yeah.
Well, if they're immortal, they should still be.
They have many incarnations.
Going strong. But yeah.
Well, Krishna is always blue, and a lot of these ancient god men were blue. So I guess he didn't know about terrain theory, that some of the germs are actually good for us. If we kill them, our bodies actually fall apart. So, but it's science fiction. So, I had no idea. And, as we get to the end, Gary, what are you working on? I was just looking around, and you've got something from H.P. Lovecraft coming.
Oh, soon? Yeah. what I've been doing recently is, I've been doing maps, writing the copy, you know, the finding the locations and writing the copy for different maps. And I've done one. Here we go. I've done one here about Aleister Crowley, The Beast in Britain. So you open it up and it's a two-sided, you know, and it has different locations throughout Britain. And then there's like an essay and all that, and then a timeline. So I've done a similar one for Lovecraft, which supposed to come out next month, and I'll be doing is I have a blog, it's gary-lockman.com, I'll be posting an article that I wrote some time ago about Lovecraft's time in Brooklyn, If you know the history, the horror at Red Hook.
Yeah.
So I have an essay called The Horror at Clinton Street, which is where Lovecraft lived when he practically went out of his mind with, you know, his xenophobia and hatred of the modern world and all that kind of thing. So I'll be putting that up, and that comes out. And I've done a couple other ones. I don't know if you know the Maigret, Inspector Maigret, who's he's a French detective. He's more European. I don't know if they translated over. I mean, they translated the language in English, but in the sense of if it's been picked up in the US as much, I don't think. There's been a couple of television series. But a lot of the stories take place in Paris. So I've done Inspector Maigret's Paris. So there was a murder here, there was something else there and all that. So, and the next one I'm doing now is about my old CBGB blank generation milieu in New York, which doesn't exist anymore. <There's> practically nothing left from those days in the 70s, but I'm doing one of that. Although I have to say, last time I was in New York, this was about 5 years ago, I, you know, took a stroll through my old haunts, and where I lived on the Bowery, two blocks away from CBGB, the club with, you know, Ramones and Talking Heads and Patti Smith and Blondie, my alma mater, where we lived in this decrepit loft space, the outside was still the same. Everywhere else around was like absolutely unrecognizable. I mean, you couldn't forget about the rents. You couldn't afford a cappuccino, you know, anywhere it is now. I mean, back in the day, the Bowery was Skid Row, you know, it was homeless. But in this place where we lived, there was still graffiti on the wall. So I thought, oh, some things stay the same. So
historical landmark.
Yeah. There should be a blue plaque. What they have here in London is a blue plaque, you know. So and so lived here. Yeah.
Very cool and very excited. Well, as we check out, I will have this on the show notes, GaryLachman.com. Highly recommend this book. Anything else you want to say that you want the audience to know about the book?
What can I say? There's a lot in there. It's Nichols' story, but it's also, as I said, the early days of the psychoanalytic or depth psychology in London. Early days of the Gurdjieff work. And then one of the other things is that Nichol was, he was an early sort of figure who, as we say, got off the grid. He created these different sort of communities outside of London. He was trying to recreate the kind of community that he lived in for a while at the Institute in France. So he was trying to create his own kind of institute. And in different places, and during the war years, and just before the war years, World War II, and then after. So, I mean, if you're interested in the sociology of early, you know, off the grid kind of people trying to be self-sustaining and all that, he's another example of that.
Yeah, I enjoyed the book. I thought it was fascinating, and it certainly, again, I have a deeper picture of, as you say, the wonderful early 20th century occultism and all the big players and geopolitics, you know, how everything falls in together. It's wonderful. So, well, thank you very much for the super chats, people. Great conversation, great comments. People really enjoyed the show, as always, when Gary is on. Vance, thanks for keeping us company. And I hope Gurdjieff is a little better on your mind.
Absolutely. No, I have a better appreciation, believe it or not. Years ago, I read Uspensky and so forth, but I have a different take on it in a little bit. So thanks, Gary.
All right. Well, I hope it doesn't keep you awake tonight, that you can indeed sleep.
Yeah, unless that lady with half of her face visits you.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
So it's absolutely my pleasure to do this all the time. So thank you again.
Well, thank you as always, Gary, and good luck with everything. Everybody, take care and have a good rest of your Tuesday, your Mars day. Take care, everybody.